Before we get started for this month's episode, I wanted to do something a bit different. We're talking about dogs today, which, as you'll learn, and if you know anything about me, you'll already know I'm obsessed with. So I wanted to start this month by just letting you guys know about the work of two amazing organizations. The first is Beagle Freedom Australia. You can find out more about them at beaglefreedomaustralia.org. So they're an organization based in Victoria, but working Australia-wide, that rehomes both dogs and cats that have previously been used in research. And the other organization that I wanted to shout out was Liberty Foundation Australia, which you can read more about at libertyfoundation.org.au. These guys rehome just about everything. So dogs, cats, guinea pigs, mice, rats, and even fish. I'm a huge believer in adopting animals, particularly as an owner of many greyhounds that are retired racers. So I really encourage you, if you're thinking about adding a furry friend to your family, to think about adopting an animal that has previously been used in research and just giving them that chance to enjoy life as a pet. All right. On with the show. Welcome to another episode of Repro Radio. This month, we are talking about something very close to my heart. We are talking about dogs. It's the other thing that's close to my heart that's not Repro.
Yeah, I feel like we frequently start off our programs with, this is close to my heart. And it's, well, it's because we're...
It's not untrue.
It's not untrue. And we are also allowed to be a little bit self-indulgent here and speak about things that we are interested in, but hopefully that you are interested in as well. We've spent a lot of time over the past two seasons talking about livestock reproduction, wildlife reproduction, mm-hmm. human reproduction. But we haven't really spoken too much about companion animals. So if you are a companion animal person, you are a small animal veterinarian who has a reproduction theragenology interest, then today's episode is for you.
Also, if you're just a regular person and you like dogs, you're also welcome.
It's true. We're not discriminatory here. Every dog interested person is welcome.
So I'm really excited to hear from our guests today. I think we're going to learn a lot because, as you said, like, our focus is ag, but I think most people who work in the repro space don't come across research in companion animals that much, because I feel like a lot of it is quite clinical research. But some of what you'll hear today from our guests is really talking about some really interesting fundamental research into reproductive biology in dogs as well.
Yeah, totally. No, it is more difficult to do research into companion animals. There are various reasons for that, which our first guest will get into, but it is a very, well, I think it's certainly one of the things that is interesting about studying animals is that every species has its own differences, and we are going to learn about some of the really weird and wonderful aspects of canine reproduction, which I will readily admit that I had no idea about, even though I nominally teach aspects of canine reproduction in my my university courses.
We've all got something to learn. So you can look forward to two interviews today, one with Dr. Corinne Renaud from the French National Institute for Agricultural Research. And our ECR for this episode is Dr. Riley Thompson from Colorado State. So look forward to hearing from both of them. Let's get into it. This episode is sponsored by the Society for Reproductive Biology, or SRB. SRB is Australia's leading organisation bringing together basic and applied reproductive scientists. They host an annual scientific meeting, which is in New Zealand this year. I'm really looking forward to it. And that program always includes great talks by both established and emerging names in repro. SRB membership will get you reduced registration fees, and it'll also allow you to apply for a raft of prestigious awards which are offered annually. Particularly important for our ECRs, think travel awards. Become an SRB member today at srb.org.au and follow them on Twitter at ReproductionSRB. Today, we are talking about one of my favourite topics ever. We're talking about dogs. And joining us, we have Dr. Corinne Renaud. And she's a researcher at the French National Institute for Agriculture, Food and Environment. So welcome.
Thank you. I'm really happy. Thanks for the invitation.
So can you start off just by telling us a little bit about your kind of research interests and how they developed over time?
I started in university. I was a big fan of biology, and I started especially reproduction when I was like 23, something like that. And my first discovery was a research unit with a lot of animals. So I started during 6 months. I worked on ovarian physiology in sheep. The objective was to study the fecundity gene, Borula, and I compared it to Belclair gene. And after that, I had really the chance to have a PhD grant and started 3 years of PhD on ovarian physiology again, but with mouse model. And it was really interesting because with the mouse model, you can do in vitro follicular genesis. So you start with small, really small follicles, and you can grow them up to ovulation in your small petri dishes and then create some pups. So it was pretty nice for 3 years. And after that, it was fantastic because I discovered also human ovarian physiology, working on in vitro maturation in human in Brussels, and also on cryopreservation of the ovary. Really nice and interesting because on human, it's rare to have a lab working on this subject. On human ovary, so it was really interesting. And my last 20 years of research was really focused on dog reproduction. Because my position was created for this special oocyte, the dog oocyte, which is a bit different from the other one. And that's why I started this job. During the last 2 years, I started a new subject on new biotechnology tools, especially organoids and spheroids on the oviduct.
Very cool. And obviously a very rich history in your career. You mentioned that, dog oocytes are a bit unique. So tell us about that. What makes them different?
So a really dark oocyte, and the most special thing is the fact that this oocyte is waiting in the ovary. Then you have an LH peak before ovulation. And the oocyte stays at the same stage, so immature GV stage. And it's just after ovulation that it will start to mature. So the dog oocyte is ready to be fertilized only three, four days after ovulation. And it's really, really strange in the classic mammals.
So would you say that our knowledge of reproduction in dogs is similar to species like cattle or humans, or is it comparatively poorly studied?
I think some aspect of the dog is well studied, especially the way we can control the cycles, because we have a lot of people interested in this subject, of course. But for ovarian physiology, dog is a difficult model because you need the organ to study the organ. And to have dog ovary, of course, it's not so easy. As a vet student and the vet in general, they are most of the time they do the castration, they neuter the animal during anastrous phase. So most of the time, the ovary you can collect, they are not really interesting, in fact.
I guess in the same vein, a lot of the surgical sterilization that happens would be in young animals as well, right? So most of the time, you're probably getting prepubertal ovaries as well.
Yeah.
Now, Corinne, I understand that, and I don't know a lot about this, that some follicles in a female actually have a couple of eggs inside of them. Dogs the only species that have this? And tell us a little bit more about these multi-oocyte follicles.
Dog follicles can have more than one oocyte inside. I've seen them for the first time when I was 25 in front of my microscope, and it was on a slide on ovary, on mouse ovaries. And I was in France, and for me, for months and years, it was one oocyte, one follicle. And two oocytes in a follicle. So, of course, I asked my supervisor, my PhD supervisor, Marc-Antoine Driancourt, "Marc-Antoine, I've seen something strange." He arrived, look at the microscope and say, "Yes, so it's a polyoocytic follicles." Oh, but for me, it was really new, really. I was, wow, it's possible.
You were ready to accept your Nobel Prize?
It was really funny. You see, the way that when you are really young in reproduction, you don't really know, you see. When I arrived in Alpha for the dog ovaries, I realized that, yes, you have more than 14% of the follicles who can have more than one oocyte. And you can have sometimes like 12, 15 oocytes for just one follicles.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize it was that high either.
Yeah, for that, the dog is really crazy. It's, of course, the most common multi-oocyte follicle have two oocytes.
Are all those eggs normal?
Around 5% of the oocyte, of the follicle, sorry, reach ovulation with more than one oocyte inside. But when you puncture them, you see that one is a winner. We never observed, even with 4, 5, 10 follicle oocyte inside, we never observed more than one good oocyte in a multi-oocytic follicles.
Really interesting. Let's talk about fertility now. So, you know, I guess a lot of other species that we talk about, particularly, you know, Simon and I are interested in agricultural species, a lot of the time they've been selected to have quite high fertility. But what about dogs? Because, you know, they went through the domestication process, but then they've been selected for very different traits. So I'm interested in your thoughts about kind of what's average fertility like in domesticated dogs?
The problem with fertility that you can observe in dogs is mainly due to the morphology of the animal, especially the problem of all this breed and sometimes some fashionable breed, like the American Bully, for example. This breed is really beautiful and really muscular, but the problem is the size. When you want a whelping to be normal, it's really difficult, and it finishes with a C-section. So the fertility problem, it's mainly this kind of problem. So, of course, some dog breeds, will disappear if you have no vet, because you need a C-section in 90% of the case. So it's mainly the morphology which is a problem. And also some specificity. For some breed, a German Shepherd, for example, the progesterone curve is not the same level than other breeds. So you have some specificity for endocrinology, but this is not a problem for fertility. So it's mainly the morphology, I think, the problem of fertility. And of course, another point is because you have in the dog just one ovulation per year, or sometimes two ovulations per year, if you don't follow the cycle, you don't know exactly where is the ovulation, when is the ovulation. And if you don't know when is the ovulation, you don't know when this oocyte, which need 2 to 3 to 4 days to be fertilizable, you don't know when you should inseminate or organize a mating. It means that fertility will be low. That's why you have some help of the vet in some large center to be sure that the fertility will be good.
It's a good segue into talking about assisted reproductive technologies in dogs. Artificial insemination is clearly pretty big business in some of the breeds, but you certainly need to know when ovulation is occurring in order to do AI successfully. There's been a fair bit of research around artificial insemination, and I think there's transcervical insemination is favoured now over the surgical insemination of frozen semen. Are these AI programs, I suppose you'd still call them, are they pretty successful in dogs, to your knowledge? Is getting good results from these AIs?
We have some breeders coming for years and years. And in this case, they know that we will have to follow ovulation, especially if you have some frozen semen, of course. Because you know that a frozen semen will not survive for days and days. So in this case, if they want some rare semen, they know that you will have we will have to organize an estrus follow-up really, yeah, at least once a day or every other day. We take some blood and we assay progesterone to follow ovulation. So I think it works, of course. It depends, like everywhere in the world, on the semen quality. And same for male.
And does dog semen freeze very well?
Oh, yeah. Dog semen freezing is really not a problem. So it's like for the cat, for example. The cat can be a problem because you have a lot of teratospermia, but a good sperm will be good in the end, of course, even after freezing. So yeah, nothing specific, no special material, no special molecules from protein, and really not a problem.
I do want to touch on the semen collection method, though, and speak a little bit about the peculiarities of that.
La vie sexuelle des chiens. Please put it in the video. But it's true that most of the time we collect the sperm, we just propose a female in heat to the dog, and we also organized once the vulvo sniff, because the problem when you have artificial insemination center is, of course, some male are really used, have a good libido, they are used to be collected. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you have almost nothing to do. You just touch the penis and everything is okay. Just small movement and that's all. I have another video on this. We send one out to one of my colleagues. I will send you the link. And in some shy animals, I have so many stories, but some shy animals in some breed, the male can be inhibited by the owner. Because the owner is really strict, and the male, you know, in animal group can reproduce only if he's in the top of the hierarchy.
Right, you have to be the alpha, right?
Exactly. And I remember once one of my clinicians told me, this guy, because he was really strict, we asked him to wait in the waiting room, but to leave us alone with the dog, because the dog was too shy to be able to give sperm in front of his owner.
Oh,
Papa is
puppy.
Here. Daddy is here. Oh, no, really, really.
Back to assisted reproduction. We talked a little bit about AI. We've talked about how to collect semen from one of the dogs. What about IVF? Is that happening at all clinically in dogs?
No, with dog, with biotechnologies, in vitro biotechnology, so in vitro maturation, fertilization and development, it's not used at all for clinics, really. I started working on dog 20 years ago. Yes. And the problem is still really, it's still a negative model. Because when you take 100 oocytes from an ovary, you have less than 20 or 30% good-looking oocytes, really more or less beautiful. And IVM is really low, meaning that you have less than 10% of the oocytes reaching mid-phase 2 fertilizable stage. And because they are not good oocytes, they are from anastrous small follicles. IVF is also a problem. So you have a lot of polyspermia because the oocyte is not really mature. And in vitro development, it's the same. They will block the embryo, if you have embryo, will block around 8 cell stage because the medium is not the good one.
And what about cloning? Because I've kind of seen online several instances of people talking about dogs having been cloned. So if IVF isn't working or I guess isn't used commercially, what are they doing for cloning?
When you want to when you need to clone, you need a lot of oocytes. So we meet again the same problem with few good oocytes. So the first, starting with a multiplicity project in the US more than 20 years ago, a businessman wanted to clone a fantastic Missy. And they tried for years and years. And finally, the first dog cloned more or less around 10 years ago. It was in the Korea, in South Korea. They have a large kennel with a lot of female, and they can collect some good quality oocyte. So they were the only pioneer for 10 years. And they produced a clone of coyotes, of sapsari, a specific Korean breed, some wolf clone. So they are really, really good for cloning. And now during the last years, it's mainly in China that you can have some business for dog cloning. And the price, because they do it really a lot, the price now is decreasing. Because the price was more than 100,000 euro before.
Oh my God!
Around 40,000 euro, but it will decrease.
That's crazy. And is it? Do you think cloning is also kind of, I guess, maybe a potential way forward for wildlife conservation as well? For you know. Wild canid species?
So the problem is you don't add some diversity with the clone, but this is a way to save some animals. If you don't want to lose these genetics and this animal is sick and this animal will die, in this case, you can try to clone to keep the genetics. But when you see the price of the cloning.
Yeah, it's tricky, isn't it? And as you said, it can't be the only thing they're doing because all it does is replicate the genes that are already there. It doesn't create any more genetic diversity, which is often the issue in conservation programs anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you touched on this a little bit earlier as well. You know, I wanna believe that most people are not interested in breeding their dogs, like most people that have dogs as a pet. So let's talk about contraception for dogs. Obviously, you know, surgical sterilization is very, very common globally. Is there research looking into alternatives to surgical spaying?
Yes, it's true that surgery is really common everywhere for the dogs, but it depends on the country. So, for example, in France, I know a bit, it's really surgery for a lot of females, not for a lot of males, because it's true that I don't know if this is a patriarchal society, but don't accept to castrate their male. You have the feeling that we castrate their own.
Yeah, that's 100% why.
We have the same in Paris. No, but it's true that surgery is well accepted in France, for example.
Mm.
In the US, they more and more, it's for them, it's not ethic to do a surgery for this. So due to the society and also due to the help of a fantastic foundation, Michelson Foundation, this foundation created really some grants to help people who try to find a non-surgical way to control reproduction, especially in dog and in stray dog especially. And depends on the country. Some specific medical treatment can be available or not. So, for example, in France, we can have the desloreline GnRH agonist implant. And the objective now is to see if this implant can block ovulation, and it works. Some teams work on this implant to block ovulation. And the other question is, can we keep this implant for a long time, for years and years, instead of surgery? So we have some research, especially on GnRH agonist or antagonist.
One thing that you mentioned early on that piqued my interest was that some of the research you're doing at the moment is in organoids. So tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, yes. Organoids is a fantastic subject.
They're very cool.
Yes, because, for decades and decades, we do some cell culture. We put some cells in plastic dishes and they grow. But because they grow like that, a lot of things are changing in these cells. Cells that lose some receptors, they stop proteins, synthesis, and a lot of things. So this is not perfect. It's not perfect to mimic in vivo, of course. Funny thing, during the last 10 years, this is organoids. Because organoids, you will produce these small organs. When you say that this is an organoid, it should reproduce some functionality of the organ. Have some in some organoids, different type of cells organizing together. And you can produce them, or you take some adult cells, and one out of 500, more or less, will be a stem cell and will be able to start an organoid from only one cell. Or you take some classic adult cell and then you modify them to have induced pluripotent stem cells. And with one cell, you can produce an organoid. And the fantastic thing is the way they organize. You have organoids from brain, and it's really, really strange, with different layers, like a mini brain. Same for prostate, from a lot of organs. And we are doing some organoids on oviducts. The objective is to mimic oviducts and to work on sperm-oviduct interaction, to know how the sperm can survive, can be perhaps selected to be a good sperm. And it's also a way for this oviduct to help the embryo later. So we have this oviduct model and also the spheroid models, when you take some epithelium, put it in the dishes, and because you have cilia on the top of epithelium, cilia will move, and it will produce after a few days, 2, 3, 4 days, small round structure, spheroids, moving for weeks and 2 or 3 weeks moving. And you have really, you can organize the meeting with sperms. You can see that the sperm will get attached on the cilia of some cells. You can see also some product, how it interacts or not. So yeah, spheroids and organoids, they are really two nice new in vitro models.
All right. Well, all I will say is thank you so much for joining us and having a very enlightening conversation about dogs. A pleasure to have you on.
Absolute pleasure.
Same here. Same here.
Welcome back for another Repro News. Naomi, what have you got for us this month?
Welcome to October, everybody. Always start with our fun fact.
Yep.
Today, we're going to learn a little bit about land slugs.
Oh.
Yeah, love a little bit of, they're in mollusca. Yeah, I'm pretty sure they're mollusks. Just making sure I remember. When they're in the throes of mating and they are hermaphrodites, so they're obviously working with both parts.
Yep.
It isn't unheard of for one of them to lose their penis in the process and they cannot regrow it, so they're now obligated to be a female and only offer their eggs.
Wow.
So an expert in the field seems to suggest that it may be that the castrator of the two slugs can raise the reproductive success by increasing the local density of females.
It's so bizarre.
Yeah, there's just some weird and wacky stuff that comes out of that world. So, yeah, couldn't help myself. all right, so now we've got our fun fact. Let's move on to some upcoming conferences. So for our lovely listeners in the veterinary world, We do have a conference. It is quite far away, mind you, but pop it in your calendar. The Vet R&D Conference in 2023, which seems forever away, but it's really not, in April 26th to 28th in Houston, Texas. Now, look, there's no mention of abstracts yet. It is still quite early, so but it says registration is open, but just have a check out and just keep an eye out for any mention of abstracts. And the second conference that I came across was actually hosted by the International Embryo Technology Society. They have a trainee group called Moralers. And they're actually hosting a virtual research meeting in October. There's no date that's been released as yet, but they are actually looking for speakers. So if you are interested in presenting at this virtual conference, check out the website and pop your name down. They might be able to slip you in. Otherwise, the conference will be in October anyway. If they're given the fact they don't have dates yet, you might miss out, but at least you can attend the virtual conference, which will be nice. With our training and workshops, so this was something that I came across. So Minitube is I feel like it's a product or it's a company that we know quite well in the reproduction world. And they actually offer some training, so either individual or open seminars. So they provide instructions on artificial insemination, embryo transfer, semen analysis, a whole bunch of stuff. And there's a lot of both practical and theory.
That's really cool. I actually had never heard of that before. So now I'm going to go and look it up because I think it might actually be really useful for students learning about reproduction as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that it has both applications, so it's not just all theory, like there's actually applied stuff, which is, what we want to know.
Yep. It's definitely what I think is the most interesting part of repro.
It is very true. I know that I am more of a fundamentalist. I'm like, ooh, how does this thing work? But then like having like, oh, that can actually be applied to this purpose is always, it's nice, always nice to have an end goal.
Yep.
It's very true. Now, our awards and grants that are coming up as well. So this one also relevant to those in not only in canine reproduction, but also in feline reproduction, the Michelson Found Animals Grant. Now, this grant is up to $250,000.
Wow.
Per year for 3 years. And this is for funding research for finding single-dose permanent non-surgical sterilization, either a product or a technology for use in either dogs or cats. You can submit a letter of intent at any time, which is fantastic. So there's no submission date. I think they said within like a month of submission, they'll review it and then go from there. And then we have two fantastic awards and grants, I should say, by the Society of Reproductive Biology that I came across. And one of these is the ECR Collaborative Travel Grant due on the 31st of October. It's $1,500. Just a nice pocket of money to be able to have the opportunity to work with someone who is not in the same uni as you, to offer that opportunity for collaboration to learn from each other. So this money can be used for planning joint research, conducting preliminary experiments, or for training as well. And then another grant for our ECRs and also MCRs as well is the seed grants. So SRB is offering six of these. And these grants are intended to provide funding to generate proof of concept data to be able to apply for bigger national, international grants in the future. Such a great scheme for our ECRs and MCRs.
I must admit, I've got a bit of background knowledge on that second grant. So I'm currently on the SRB council. And what I have to do is just make a big shout out to the treasurer of SRB, who's actually our guest on the next episode, Dr. Kelly Walton, for getting that seed grant scheme off the ground. This is her brainchild, and she was really excited to be able to just offer these small grants to help people kind of early on in their career who are really just starting out or getting established as investigators, because even though it's a small amount of money, it can make such a huge difference in generating preliminary data that can be used in larger grant applications. So Thanks, Kelly, for having us in your mind and for helping us all out. And I really encourage everybody to have a go, put in an application for these grants.
Yeah, it's a foot in the door.
Exactly.
Right? You need those little stepping stones. It's not always about applying for that massive big grant. Mm-hmm. You need to be able to apply for those small ones, and they all count for something. So it doesn't matter what the pot of money is. If you can use it for something, yep, just go for it.
Exactly.
Yeah. So those two amazing grants. So that one is due on the 12th of October. So mid-October, and then the travel grant is in late October. Now for our publication of the month. Now this one, we're kind of getting back to the fundamentals of optimizing protocols, which I think are really important papers. So this one is the cryopreservation of testicular tissue from the dog and wild boar by slow freezing and vitrification, differences in cryoresistance according to cell type. I think especially considering the field of canine reproduction is still developing, if mm-hmm. we, you know, compare it to livestock species, yep, or lab species like mice, these papers may seem like, you know, like they're quite early on, but they're so integral. Yeah, really nice technical paper, really nice results in there. So yeah, have a read.
Nice. And yeah, I mean, it is also important to think about, I guess, emergency gamete storage as well. So
exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Apart from, you know, obviously our wildlife species, there are particular breeding males of lots of different species that are worth a ridiculous amount of money. Like I know mm-hmm. particularly yeah. we're obviously from the livestock world, so that's what we tend to think about. But, you know, there are some animals that are selling for hundreds of thousands of dollars, these yeah. elite breeding males. If one of them happens to drop dead, you don't have a lot of options in terms of preserving their fertility post-mortem. So these papers are so incredibly important because they're developing those technologies for this sort of emergency gamete storage that can really make a huge difference long term by just preserving the genetics of those males.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. And like, as you said, in situations where producing semen is not possible, especially with endangered species as well.
Thanks so much, Naomi, for keeping us up to date, and we'll see you next month.
Sounds good. See you then.
Today I am speaking with postdoc Dr. Riley Thompson, whose current research at Colorado State University involves developing 3D organoid cultures from the reproductive tissues of various domestic species, including canines, to evaluate their secreted extracellular vesicles as a model for normal physiology. Riley, welcome to Repro Radio. Can we just unpack that? So I obviously stalked you a little bit to check out your research background, and I think I was hooked from the word organoid. Very cool. What are you researching at the moment?
Yeah, so as you said, we've been working with canine, feline, equine, and bovine reproductive tissue, so especially endometrium and oviduct, to just try to grow them three-dimensionally, more similar to what happens in the body. And then we can use those to understand the normal physiological processes better, but then also understand different disease states and potentially test out therapeutics to work with them. One of the branches in our lab is to use fetal stem cells from canine tissues and the extracellular vesicles that they produce as a potential therapeutic. So especially for things like endometritis, we can infuse those into the uterus to try and treat them as an alternative to adding cells like stem cells. And especially in the canine, this would be really useful because diseases like pyometra and endometritis in the canine are really challenging to treat because unlike horses and cows, where you can flush the uterus with saline to try and clean things out, because of the unique anatomy of the canine, we really can't do that. So this is an interesting alternative therapeutic to try and help some of these disease states.
Unreal. And just what a beautiful model to be working with. Are you at the stage now with these therapeutics and things where they're almost ready to be translated into industry or into practice, or is it still much of a developmental sort of stage?
Still a lot of developmental, but the equine fetal stem cell extracellular vesicles, that was actually done with a collaboration between my boss, Fiona Hollinshead, and then Larry Chan in Auckland. And so they have done the equine cells and treated endometritis with those. So those are something that could definitely be in some more clinical trials to kind of come up with the most effective treatment protocols that could help reduce things like post-breeding endometritis. So that one's close. Another project we've been trying to find funding for would be using organoids and the extracellular vesicles they secrete as a way of producing a novel contraceptive. So that's another thing that could be clinically relevant. We just, it's not quite to the level of being able to be used in industry yet.
Wow, that is unreal. I mean, so many applications just from this one thing. So before you were doing this, you were also doing some work at the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, working with various assisted reproductive technologies for some quite niche species, actually. What was it like to work there? Because I think that is one institute that, certainly in the States at least, people actually sort of know a little bit about it. It's somewhat infamous.
It was super cool. I actually miss it a lot. When we were able to handle the Schabowski's horse or the Persian onager or some other ungulates that we worked with, most of the time we were doing things like ultrasounds and artificial insemination. And I just want to give a quick shout out to the amazing animal keepers that are there, because they're able to train them to go into the chute system and allow us to do these procedures. So they're pretty amazing. And then my former mentor there, Buddha, is amazing. He's one of my favorite people, just enthusiastic. Where I worked was the Smithsonian Conservation Biology Institute. There's different health research going on. There's reproductive research. They also do things related to animal movements, so GIS and ecology. And so it's a pretty interesting facility.
Wow, you've just had so many cool experiences. You're actually from a veterinary background. Did you sort of think that you would end up here? What kind of drew you to this reproductive research field rather than, I suppose, what we consider a normal route of clinical practice for a lot of veterinarians?
I wanted to do this. Initially, I wanted to be an equine surgeon, but I always liked reproduction. I had a really great professor, so I really enjoyed that. And then I had a mentor in vet school who had a research project, and she offered to send me. And so I said, well, I'm not going to turn down a trip to Africa. So yeah, I'll try out this research thing that I don't know anything about. And so I spent one summer in Zimbabwe and decided to, after that, to do a PhD after finishing vet school. And that's what sent me up to the Smithsonian. And it just sort of ended up this way, being able to combine all of the things that I enjoy. So I found out that I really like research. I can ask a question and then formulate an experiment and then figure out how to answer the question. And then I get to do reproduction still. And then sometimes I still get to work with wildlife. So it's been a nice mixture of all the things that I enjoy.
Amazing. Well, it sounds like you've had a really interesting and very colorful career. And I really look forward to seeing where you head next with this, because I think there's a lot of exciting application and definitely more mechanistic stuff that's going to come from your work. So Riley, thank you so much for coming on today. It's been really interesting talking to you, and I look forward to hearing about your future.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, I definitely learned something today. I had come across this concept of multi-oocyte follicles before, but I didn't know whether or not all of the oocytes in those follicles were actually viable and, you know, could go on to be fertilized and be developmentally competent. So really interesting to hear from Corinne that usually only one of them ends up actually being, I guess, the winner of that follicle.
Totally. That's it's probably my main take-home message from today, is that follicles can have more than one egg, and that the prevalence of that is quite high or higher in the canine species rather than in livestock and humans as well. But it's still something which happens. So I definitely have added to my reproduction knowledge repertoire there. The other thing that I think was really interesting today was the conversation from both of our guests about the use of organoids in the most recent years in reproduction research.
Yeah, organoids are something that I will never not be fascinated by. They're so cool to look at under the microscope, but just the idea generally of being able to capture what's going on in 3D in a much more, I guess, comprehensive way in vitro.
Yeah, fantastic. New or perhaps not super new, but relatively new tool for all of us in the reproductive biology field to think about using in our research.
So we really hope you enjoyed this episode. Our next episode is the last one for the season. We finally made it to the end of the year and we've got a great episode. It's one that I think will hopefully draw a pretty big audience and a pretty diverse crowd because we're going to start talking about endocrinology.
Yes, and as we tell our undergraduate and graduate students that we teach, endocrinology underpins all of reproduction, and if the endocrinological system is not working, then reproduction is not working all that well. So we have Dr. Kelly Walton from latterly of Monash University and a relatively recent addition to the team at the University of Queensland. So she'll be talking about some of the fantastic research that she's doing there.
Really looking forward to it, and we'll catch up with you guys then. Thanks for joining us. For more information about our guests today or Repro news, check out the show notes for this episode on our website. If you've got a question for our next guest, send us an email or find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Repro Radio is hosted and produced by me, Taylor Pinney, and executive produced by Simon DeGraff. Repro News by Naomi Bernicich, ACR Spotlight Reporting by Kelsey Poole, production assistance by Jess Rickard, Maddie Vanderhoek, and Sophie Waugh, and audio design by Dylan Gerrilly.